Saram, dear listeners, and welcome once again to Vahini Satsang. Today is December 26th, the Christmas fever is on. And if you are in Sai Kulwant Hall or watching the videos, wherever you are, the phrase that will keep occurring in front of you again and again is Christmas, the power of love. This is what is there on all the banners inside the ashram. Love is in the air, just like it is during every festival. But during Christmas, the fervor, the gaiety, and the varied colors of this happiness that you see is so beautiful, so unique. We are in the seventh chapter of Sandeha Nivarini. And if you've been following our discussions, for a change in this chapter, Bhagwan as Bhakta said, I don't want to ask any questions, I don't have any doubt. Swami, you just give me some tenets of your message that I can practice in my daily life, which will take me closer to you. And the very first thing that Bhagwan says is prema, love, should be considered as the very breath of life. Believe that the love which manifests in all beings equally, assuming different forms, is indeed Paramatma. Have the conviction that the one Paramatma is in everyone as the embodiment of love. So the message is so emphatically on the principle of love. In fact, this is the bedrock of Bhagwan's teachings. We did spend time discussing these tenets, and any number of sessions are insufficient to dwell on this principle of love because it is synonymous with the principle of divinity. But we have to move on, and that is how we moved on to the subsequent segments of Chapter 7 of Sandeha Nivarini. And we are now in the third segment. Today Bhagwan has sent to the studios two beautiful souls who have been spending their time trying to assimilate these beautiful gems of wisdom. One of them is a former student of Bhagwan's university, Brother Vikas Bagri. He had the opportunity to do his master's in business administration here and also has been involved in the Delhi Satyasai organizations for many years, leading various initiatives, all centered on the theme of fostering and disseminating the five principles of Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema and Ahimsa. We also have Brother Venkat Reddy from Australia, who again, in his own way, has been trying to see how to make this principle of love work wherever you are. If listeners recall, we did have sessions with him earlier on an initiative called Love at Work that this brother and his team of Sai brothers and sisters have been working on for so many years. Really grateful to Swami that we have these two lovely Sai brothers today as we discuss Chapter 7.3 of Sandeha Nivarini. So let's listen to what Bhagwan has written and then we'll pray to Swami to guide our thoughts.
15. Try to keep under check the five sins that the body commits: killing, adultery, theft, drinking intoxicants, and meat eating. The sacred life can reach the highest if these can be completely avoided. 16. One must be always vigilant, without a moment's carelessness, against the eight sins that the mind perpetrates: kamam or lust, krodham or anger, lobham or greed, moham or attachment, mada or ego, envy, hatred and pride. Man's primary duty is to keep all these things at a safe distance. 17. When in pursuit of wrong actions, man's mind acts hurriedly. During these times, without allowing the mind to go its way, remember the name of the Lord and attempt to do some good deed or the other. Those who do thus will certainly become fit for the grace of the Lord. 18. First, give up the evil tendency to feel envious at the prosperity of others and the desire to harm them. Be happy that others are happy. Sympathize with those who are in adversity and wish for their well-being. This is the sign of God's love present in you. 19. Patience is all the strength that man needs. 20. Those who aspire for happiness must be engaged in good deeds. 21. It is easy to conquer anger through love, attachment through reasoning, falsehood through truth, bad through good, and greed through charity. 22. Do not respond to the words of the wicked. It is good to keep them at a distance. In fact, do not have any relationship with such people. 23. Seek the company of good men, even at the cost of your honor and life. However, pray to God to bless you with the discrimination needed to distinguish between the good and the bad. You must also endeavor to do this with the intelligence given to you. 24. No doubt, those who conquer kingdoms and earn fame in the world are hailed as heroes. But truly, those who have conquered the senses must be acclaimed as the conquerors of the universe. 25. The results of one's action, whether good or bad, continue to always pursue man. 26. Greed yields only sorrow. Contentment is best. There is no happiness greater than contentment. 27. The evil manipulations of the mind has to be uprooted, else it will ruin life itself. 28. Bear with fortitude both loss and grief, and search for that which will benefit you and grant you joy. 29. When you are invaded by anger, practice silence or remember the name of the Lord. Do not remind yourself of things which will inflame the anger more. That will do incalculable harm. 30. From this moment, avoid all bad habits. Do not delay or postpone. They do not contribute the slightest joy or happiness.
Salam, brothers.
Salam, Bishu.
Salam.
Well, I think as I was listening to all the points, it almost seemed like each point needs so much time to even put your head, wrap your head around it. And there is so much that, you know, one can discuss about each point here. Anyway, so before we go to 7.3, there's one thing in 7.2 which I felt was not discussed in the previous session, and I think that was a very important thing. Swami is saying that the spirit of self-sacrifice is at the heart of all-encompassing compassion towards all beings. And it just felt that this is a very, very important statement. This is something which should be our touching stone when we do any selfless service act. Because Swami is saying that your compassion, all encompassing compassion, if is not guided by self-sacrifice, then it's of no meaning. And I was reminded of a few instances from Bhagwan's life, from the lives of students. And what immediately came to my mind is that story of the boy when the super speciality hospital construction was going on. It was 1990, and when one day Swami suddenly came out of the interview room and he was in a hurry, he was holding that piece of paper in his hand and he was saying, "Who is the boy who wrote this letter?" And when the boy came forward, Swami said, "This 100 rupees is more precious to me than the 100 crores that I might have received for the super speciality hospital. It is because this boy had written, 'Swami, you are building such a beautiful home of compassion and I don't know how I can be part of it. I so much want to be part of it. And for the last 3 months, I have started washing my own clothes.' I remember in those days, we used to have our monthly laundry charges as 30 rupees. And so for 3 months, he had washed his clothes and saved 90 rupees, and so that is how he had got his 100 rupees. And he said, 'Swami, if you can buy even one brick for the hospital with this money, I would feel fulfilled.' And Swami came out with so much happiness and then made that profound statement. When I look at the Satya Sai organization, you look at the various initiatives that Bhagwan asked the devotees to undertake as part of their sadhana. Way back in the 70s and 80s, when Bhagwan used to talk about sealing on desires, Swami used to always say that whatever service you do, let it be something for which you have given up. Let it be something which you sacrifice. You give up something of the world so that the Lord can take you up." Now, Swami used to say that, you know, if you are doing Narayan Seva, then every time when you're having, you're cooking your food, keep the same rice, you keep some aside. So you sacrifice a little of what you thought you will consume and give that as an anseva. So for Swami, that was important. It was not important that you every day feed 100 people or 1,000 people. For Swami, it was very important that what you restrained yourself and denied yourself some comforts where somebody else can be benefited. So I think that whole spirit, where Swami is saying the spirit of self, because only then that seva can uplift you. Only then that seva can take you closer to God. Only then that seva will become a sadhana. And so there is no point if whatever service we are doing, if it does not have this as the underlying principle. And I think, and I thought we should really spend some time on this, because seva is such an important activity of the Satya Sai organization. It is called Sri Satya Sai Seva Organization in India. And to understand this concept of service is so important. Of course, as you think more about this whole concept of self-sacrifice, and so many thoughts emerge, and ultimately you will definitely think about what is the self and what is it to be sacrificed. But I thought this is something that every devotee who is in the Sai fold, who wants to do service, should think about, isn't it?
Absolutely agree, Bishu. And it brings to mind what the word sacrifice itself means to us. And when I think of sacrifice, I think there are a few things associated with it. For example, we might say, well, I'm sacrificing time in this activity to do something else. So it's giving up that that resource, whether it's time or money or whatever it is, giving up a portion of it. The second aspect that comes to mind is that there should be some kind of pain, that we should feel that, yeah, this is actually not easy for me, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. If it's too easy, then I don't think that's sacrifice. I think a little bit of pain, a little bit of discomfort should be there. And the third aspect that comes to mind is that in this, the example that you shared about this student who put aside 30 rupees every month for 3 months, the brick would have been bought, or the brick that he had sort of earmarked, I guess, with this 90 rupees, would have been bought some months down the line. But his act of sacrifice took place over many months preceding that actual purchase of that brick. Whether that brick was purchased, or a needle was purchased, or anything, a sod of earth was purchased. That's the other aspect, I think, of sacrifice, is that it kind of precedes the act. So it engages you in that service even before the act of service takes place. So in your mind, in your body, already that connection with the recipient of your act is beginning. And I think that's the first step, really, in recognizing the oneness between you and the person at the end of this act. Those are just some thoughts that come to mind as I heard that very beautiful episode that you shared.
Yeah.
I think one very easy way to understand self-sacrifice is to just go back and look at your mother.
Yeah.
You know, the closest and the best act of self-sacrifice day in, day out, year in, year out.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you'll understand what it means, whether it be the pain that, brother, you just said, or, you know, giving up something for the other.
Mm.
And how a mother does it effortlessly.
Yes.
You know, it just flows without a second thought that, you know, maybe I'll get less food, but, you know, the baby or the child, you know, should get enough.
Yes.
And that's such a beautiful example to learn from.
Absolutely. I mean, it's spontaneous.
And I think it sort of countermands one of my aspects of sacrifice, which is the sense of pain. I get the feeling that you know, watching mothers and watching my wife as well. We've got a 5.5-year-old daughter that she will make all sorts of what I would call sacrifice without that sense of pain.
Yeah.
Just as you say, as a matter of course.
Yeah.
Let me just do this.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even think mothers think, oh, this is my duty or any such kind of high level thinking. It's just something that has to be done. Spontaneously, it is done.
Yeah.
It's only outside observers who will see that and say, oh, you sacrificed something.
Yeah.
You gave up something for the sake of your child.
Yeah.
I'm sure they don't sense it like that. And that actually underlines the goodness, the absolutely immeasurable goodness of motherhood, as you say.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, those are, when you look at the mother or when you look at the divine mother, Swami, I mean, you can very easily, I mean, every act of Bhagwan surfaces in your mind whenever you talk about, you know, all encompassing compassion, because that's what Bhagwan was. Anything that he did, be it, I remember when the Orissa housing project happened, Swami said that, you know, I want to sell off the house in Kodaikanal. I want to sell off, I want to sell the airport. For the drinking water project that happened in 1995, Swami actually took loan. The whole Prashantilam Ashram was mortgaged and he took loan. So, I mean, that is how Bhagwan was telling us, showing us about, you know, what it means.
That is the extent he was prepared to go to.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Or rather, that's the state which he wants us to aspire to.
Yes.
Right? And so what's blocking us to reach that state?
That's an excellent question. Well, if you ask me to sacrifice something, Vikas, it's because, I don't want to sacrifice it or give it up. It's because I want that thing.
Mm-hmm.
I want it for myself. I don't want you to have it. I don't want anybody else to have it. So I will not sacrifice it because I want it too much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's, you know, in my mind, the obstacle is that want, that desire, that attachment to that particular resource.
Yeah.
Mm. And it makes me also think, you know, at a personal level, what does self-sacrifice mean? We're talking about acts of service, but is there, you know, should we consider self-sacrifice in everyday acts, not just service projects or, you know, deliberately going out of one's way to help another being, but just in everyday acts as we get up, brush our teeth, get ready for work, go to work, you know, do our work, come back, have our lunch, whatever it is there, should we be thinking about self-sacrifice in other acts?
Yeah. In fact, you know, just to think of the language, and I'm just trying to, I just noticed when you say, should we think of such acts, versus when you said, the mother just does it effortlessly. She doesn't think of such acts, right? So I think there's a difference between, you know, trying to think of it and then see if you want to do it, and then your mind comes into play, and then the emotion and the attachment and so on.
That's right.
Versus when you just do it effortlessly.
Effortlessly.
And what makes the mother actually do that effortlessly? Right? If you look at, you know, again, you know, our own mothers or the divine mother as an example, it's their level of, you know, the selflessness in their love, the purity of love.
Yes.
As one of the verses also, it was mentioned, you know, we are love. There's a lot of karma, krodha, lobh, mad, moh, etc., etc. And that makes us impure.
Yes.
Which is the obstacle in that effortless flow of selflessness or self-sacrifice.
I agree. Just a few points on that, Vikash. You mentioned, you know, about the mother who does this effortlessly, whereas we are thinking about it. I have this feeling that if we asked mothers, if we lined up 10 mothers in this room, and asked them, why do you do it? I suspect they'll struggle to actually give us a rational answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually the issue. There's no rational answer.
Yeah.
Mm.
all we can do, I think, is observe and make some inferences. And when I look at the significant mothers in my life, that's my wife, my own mother, my mother-in-law, my sister, these are the four women who are the mothers in my life. And when I observe them, not just towards, you know, their children, my sister and her children, you know, my mother-in-law and, you know, her two daughters and me, and my mother and me and my brother, etc., but towards others, there is this maternal feeling that seems to flow. And what I infer from that is that they don't see a distinction between them and their child.
Yeah.
That's why it flows. If there was some sort of a distinction, any barrier in between them and the child, the flow would stop. That's what barriers do. They stop the flow of stuff.
No separation. Yeah.
So it just flows.
Yeah.
When we observe it from outside, we see it as a flow.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing to see. Now, for us who are never going to be mothers, but who revere mothers greatly, what is the challenge for us? As you said, you know, those enemies, the inner enemies that are there. Now, on this point, Bishu, I'm a little bit scared. I've got to admit,
mm-hmm.
because up till now I thought there were six inner enemies.
Uh-huh.
Now there are eight. And I'm going to be honest with you. I'm thinking, what? I thought six was hard enough, but eight. So we just increased the amount of work.
The opposition army just got bigger.
How did that happen?
Mm.
And I guess that the challenge before us is how do we remove those obstacles so that that compassion, that feeling, that love can flow as we observe in our mothers.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. So I think that is where we come to 7.3 from 7.2. And yes, I mean, as you very rightly said, for the divine it is easy because for the divine there is no distinction. I mean, ultimately when you say self-sacrifice, what has to be sacrificed is a body consciousness. Mm. And for the divine has no body consciousness. So he feels the pain of every thing, every person, every being of the universe. And that is how it was. You know, if you look at most of the service projects, I mean, nobody came and told Swami that something is happening in Orissa. Swami does not read newspapers or nobody came and told Swami that, you know, in East West Godavari, Swami, the tribal villages are suffering. It was all those spontaneous acts, and Swami was just putting out a few models for us to emulate. So, yes, so in a whole journey of self-sacrifice, until you reach that level of, you know, you not identifying with your body, you know, sacrificing sort of this body consciousness. But I think slowly we have to start giving up things so that we build that virtue of selflessness, so that we feel not just for my body and just my family, and slowly start expanding that horizon, and slowly, you know, that is the only way we will get out of it. And I think that's what every activity in the Satasaya organization also moves towards. I mean, prepares us for that. Now, even before we go to point number 16, where Swami is talking about this eight sins that the mind perpetrates, Swami talks before that about the five sins that the body commits.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami is talking about here: killing, adultery, theft, drinking intoxicants, and meat eating. Mm-hmm. And Swami says the sacred life can reach the highest if these can be completely avoided. I remember, I think it was 70th birthday discourse, if I'm not wrong. It was one of those mega celebrations in the Hillview Stadium, one of the landmark birthdays. And Swami declared that for anyone to be a follower of Sri Satya Sai, you have to give up meat eating, you have to give up drinking, You have to give up smoking. I mean, these are the basic things. You know, generally, Bhagwan would always talk about spiritual concepts about love and, you know, service and those kind of ideas. But here was one occasion when Swami was saying that these are the, like, the basic things.
Yes.
If you even think of embarking on the spiritual path, you know, if you want Sai to be associated in any way with what you are doing, then you have to give up these three things. And so here Bhagwan is telling the only way you can lead a sacred life is, these are the basics actually, that way, you know, killing, adultery, theft, drinking intoxicants and meat eating. In fact, when I read this killing and adultery, what suddenly came to mind is the beautiful story of Ahalya in Ramayana. And I think there was one lovely episode where as Rama is going through the forest and he comes across this beautiful erstwhile ashram which is now dead and there's no one looking after and so the sage, I think Agastya, who was with Swami, with Sri Rama, so he starts to explain that, you know, this was this ashram of sage Gautama and how once Gautama's wife Ahalya was there inside and how Indra came and tricked her and she did not know because Indra took the form of sage Gautama and that is when she regarded her as her husband. And when sage Gautama returned and he saw that they are together and he was upset and how he cursed her. And he said that, may you become like a stone, may you become, you know, lifeless because you have done something which is so not human. You don't deserve to be a human being, even though it was a game that was played by the divine. And when the wife pleaded with him, saying that, you know, I did not know, and he had took upon your form, he had taken upon your form and all that. And then he said, oh, I have already given this word. I mean, my words will come true because that's how the words of the rishis are. Just, but he said, you don't worry. You know, fifth time Rama will come here, when Lord Rama comes to this ashram, with his sparshan, sambhashan and darshan, you will be transformed. And Swami says that it was not as if she became a stone. Her life was like that of a stone, Swami says, because she was just, she became still and she stopped eating food. She was just living on air and just doing severe austerities. And everything around her had grown and she was like how fire is covered by smoke.
Yes.
That is how she was. And then Swami came and when Rama came and with all love and Rama touched and everything transformed. So to me it's a very, very symbolic story and a very profound story of how it is so important to convert. If you have any of these vices, then your heart will become a stone. You will not be a human being. I think that is so powerfully conveyed. You know, if you are engaged in killing, if you are engaged in adultery, then you don't deserve to be a human being. You are a stone. And who can emancipate you? It is only the darshan, sparshan and sambhashan. Only that will liberate you. Only that can make you back into a human being. Later on, you'll become something divine.
It'll be a long road, though, because you know, we don't want people taking to these vices saying that, well, that'll attract the Lord's mercy on me and he'll come and turn me into a human being. the thing that strikes me about those particular vices is that they're quite gross. They can be observed by anybody. If you're killing, if you're committing adultery, if you're eating meat, etc. They are visible acts They're not easy to hide, those sorts of things. And in the next paragraph, when he talks about those inner enemies, they strike me as things which are more subtle.
Yeah.
For example, I could be sitting here being a really
correct
goody-goody person, but inside,
yeah,
I have jealousy towards you. Inside, I'm
yes
actually seething with anger.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, but maybe I'm a good actor.
Yeah. Mm.
And you can't see that, mm, but I'm still experiencing it.
Mm.
Yeah. And so I think it's a very, very important point that Swami is making to us.
Mm.
That start at the gross,
mm,
bare minimum.
Mm.
You cannot even enter
yes
the house,
mm,
even the compound, the yard of the gate,
mm,
if you're doing these things. Once mm you enter the yard,
yes,
to enter the house, there are certain subtler vices
mm
that need to be given up.
True. I think, and when Bhagavan is talking about the other, as you mentioned, the basic things, the gross things, you have again theft, drinking intoxicants and meat eating.
Mm.
And one other little story that Bhagavan used to mention in this connection is how this monk once went to this village, and so everyone wanted to extend their hospitality to this holy man, and how this pious couple call this monk to the home for food, and the wife who was supposed to cook was unable to do it in the last minute, so she calls the neighbor to do the cooking, and the neighbor does all the preparations, and the monk has a very nice lunch, but somehow he has this irresistible desire to steal that silver cup, mm, and you know, and so he takes it, and the couple feel okay because they feel okay, maybe it is divine will, you know, it is not there. But once the monk goes back and he feels very repentant about what he had done, I mean, it is so unbecoming of him,
mm,
you know, he thought it's such a disgraceful, like how could he do it? Yeah, and then, you know, he comes back and whatever, and he asks for pardon and all that. But the important thing that Swami conveyed when he narrated the story is about when the monk asked himself, you know, how could this happen? How could I even get this thought? And that is when he realized that the neighbor who came and cooked was someone who was deeply into stealing, and that is the reason why that tendency got into the food.
Were transferred
into the food. So here, you know, you have everything here. I mean, one thing is, you know, how, of course, the whole thing of stealing,
mm,
and how that affects the food.
Yes.
So Swami is so clear that when even your thoughts, forget the gross aspect, when your thoughts can affect the food,
yes,
when your thought of stealing can affect the food, imagine what impact it will have if you're eating stuff,
yeah,
which are made out of hate.
Yes.
Eating stuff,
yes,
which can be made only when you hurt another person,
yes,
or hurt another living being.
Yes.
Hurt another living being. Mm. So Swami says, how can you even think that you will not have animal qualities when you are eating animal food?
Yes. And that's the link, isn't it?
Between yeah
the gross and the subtle.
Mm-hmm.
That the food is something gross. You know,
yes,
it's matter.
It's yes
got volume and mass,
mm,
and taste and color.
Yeah.
And an aroma. So this thing, which is quite gross, has such subtle impacts on us. The other point that Bishu made earlier, Vikas, is that, you know, slowly this transformation takes place in us. And we were speaking earlier about the shedding of these vices as being a journey.
Yeah.
Like any journey sort of starts at some point.
Yeah.
There is a destination and there is a journey in between. Did you want to sort of share some thoughts about the journey aspect of addressing these vices?
Sure. No, I'd like to stitch together some of the things we've said until now,
mm,
from how the love flows effortlessly from a mother,
mm,
you know, the idea of self-sacrifice, the way Bishu talked about, you know, these stones, I mean, how she turned into a stone, stone-like.
Mm. Yes.
Right? Living, but with those, and those stones actually, which are your vices, actually blocking the flow of love, mm. which is inherent in you, which is inherent in every mm. human being.
Mm.
And even what, you know, in the drama today and Swami's discourse yesterday, where both talked about, Swami very clearly said that every human being is born to be a messenger of God, to be a messenger of love, right? And all these acts are actually just stones which block.
Hmm.
Plus, when Swami talks about, you know, when he says that his mantra to all of us, the simplest mantra anybody has ever given of love all, serve all, and help ever, hurt never. I think that's really, I look at that as a journey.
Hmm.
You know, when, if we take our own examples, you know, we obviously love ourselves, and then we love our family, and then immediate friends, and then, you know, it sort of slowly starts, the curve starts going down.
Hmm.
Right? And I think our spiritual journey is really from, you know, taking that love one person, which is us, to love all. So one to all is the journey.
Mm.
Right? And that journey involves, you know, removing these vices, working on these different aspects, really purifying yourself.
Mm.
And every act, every opportunity that you have in 24 hours a day, Swami has told time and again, you can use every act to purify yourself. Every act as an act of love. Every act as an act of service. And the Satya Sai Seva organization becomes a training ground for a lot of that.
Mm.
You know, I'm sure all of us will agree that sometimes we are of a different color when we're in our house, and we change the color when we go and serve in the Satya Sai organization. You know, suddenly we start speaking very sweetly, and there are too many Sai rounds which come out,
yeah.
and there's, you know, a little more affection and love towards everybody when
yes.
we meet there or when we come in Parthi. And as soon as we are back into our room, you know, the color changes a little.
Yeah.
So I think all of these are is a practice ground for us to really open our heart to more and more. You know, that one to infinite, one to all is the journey. And this becomes a tool to serve others.
Yeah.
I mean, love and serve are frankly two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
Like you earlier mentioned, the idea of separateness.
Yes.
You know, if the mother doesn't think that she's separate from the child, the love flows effortlessly.
Yes.
If Swami doesn't think that we are all separate from him, his love flows effortlessly. And in our lives, our love also flows effortlessly for few people.
Mm-hmm.
And for others, it doesn't flow because of the idea of separateness, because of these
yeah.
stones that are blocking.
Yes.
So if we open up, if we, through this process of self-transformation, of purifying ourselves, we slowly include more and more into the idea of not being separate and the unity of life, right? When we start understanding that principle, I think love will naturally flow out.
Yeah. I think there's, in what you've just said, there are two huge beacons of hope. And the first massive beacon that's sitting on top of a mountain, you know, radiating its life, its light in 360 degrees, as far as I can see, is that this love, this compassion is within us. It's already inherent in us.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if that wasn't the case and you'd have to get it from somewhere else and you'd have to make it fit for purpose that, okay, I've got to customize this love to this particular mentality, personality called Venkat Reddy or Vikas. That would be a big task.
Yeah.
But instead, there's this big beacon of hope. It's actually already there.
Mm.
That should give us all a lot of hope. And when Swami says this again and again, every time he speaks to us, he reiterates this, calling us embodiments of divine love. He's telling us it's already there. Guys, I'm going to start by telling you what's already there.
Yeah.
So
in fact, just sorry to interrupt you, but there is something very interesting that Swami has said. I just read it this morning, where Swami says, do you know why a person is called Vyakti. You know, a person is called Vyakti in Sanskrit, in Hindi, in many Indian languages. And Swami says it is because there is something latent in us, which is avyakta. Swami says, vyakta is to express, you know, right. That's in Sanskrit. So Swami says, when avyakta becomes vyakta, then it becomes, you become a vyakti. So what is latent? What is avyakta is latent. Avyakta is something that you're not able to understand.
Yes.
Okay, that is latent. And Swami says, what is latent? It is love.
Yes.
So when the love becomes patent,
yes,
vyakta, then you become vyakti, Swami says.
Beautiful. It's in physics terms, it's a transformation of potential energy to kinetic energy.
Yeah.
It's from something that's stored to becoming manifest, to becoming active.
Yeah.
And then the second huge beacon of hope that you mentioned, Vikas, is as we go through the day, you know, the opportunities. That gives me a lot of hope. It tells me that during the day, I've got so many opportunities to refine myself, to actually chip away at these enemies. I don't have to wait for the end of the week when we go and do some big massive service project where we clothe and feed people or do whatever it is, or go to bhajans or whatever that kind of landmark activities in the week or the month. If you're unlucky, every month or every 3 months you do something. It gives me hope to say, look, every day from the time I wake up, that the time I, you know, regain consciousness to the time I surrender consciousness to the womb of sleep, I have got innumerable opportunities through which I can actually put some focus, a little bit of focus on these enemies. And again, the great hope that you mentioned is that, yes, it's a journey.
Yeah.
So I don't have to conquer all of this in one day.
Yeah.
I just have to have that spirit of self-sacrifice, that inner motivation, that spirit which is an ethereal thing, almost intangible, but it's there, its presence and its essence can be felt.
Yeah.
That spirit that, yes, I have the tendency, I have the motivation, I want to actually chip away at these, because yes, I want that latent energy, that love to just flow. You know, I want to experience that, and I want to put that on everybody around me.
And just to, you know, one can easily visualize that journey as if, you know, this whole journey is like climbing Mount Everest, right? You just suddenly don't decide today that tomorrow I'm going to climb Mount Everest and, you know, reach the peak next day.
Yeah.
Even months and sometimes years before you climb Mount Everest, you know, there's so much of training that you undergo.
Mm.
Now imagine, you know, that is something, if you compare this to your own spiritual journey, how much effort we would put in, you know, having to climb Mount Everest, and how much more effort there is into our own spiritual journey, how much more training, you know, we need. And after all the training, when we think we are ready for the journey, we reach base camp and we start climbing thereafter, how tough that journey is. It has its own ups and downs. You know, there'll be days when you can't make the climb.
Mm.
There'll be times when you're afraid you might want to run back to base
camp. And there'll be days when you've climbed 100 meters or half a kilometer and you just slipped.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there'll be failures and there'll be successes in the journey. And I think we should talk a little bit about how does that look, you know?
Successes and failures.
Yes. And what does it mean in the spiritual journey? And how do we really know we're, you know, climbing in the right direction and not some other mountain since we've never, you know, made this climb earlier?
Are we at the base of Everest or some other mountain? I mean, those are very, very good questions. And we should start addressing those questions with the first answer that so many people have climbed Everest.
Yeah.
Therefore, it is possible.
True.
It is possible.
Yes.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Sir Edmund Hillary, who was the first person to climb Mount Everest, I think in 1952 with Sherpa Tenzing, the two of them, when he was asked, why did you climb Mount Everest? I believe he is said to have replied, because it's there. So I think we can take a similar attitude, a similar spirit to the Everests that face us.
In fact, Swami is making it very clear. He's saying this is man's primary duty.
Mm. Wow.
So it is there.
It is there.
It's right there.
It's got to be climbed. And then I think we can move to your questions, which is, what does that look like? You know, what does success and failure look like? What happens if you do, as you say, Bishu, you know, go 100 meters and slip back 200 meters? Yeah. Or as was said in the kids' play today, children's play today, take one step forward and three steps back. That's going to be part of the journey, because a lot of factors are not in your control. The climatic conditions, the terrain conditions, although you've trained, are not in your control. So backslides are going to happen. How do we deal with them?
I mean, you learn to, first time when you slipped the 200 meters down, and now when you climb again, now your muscles are stronger. So with time, if you learn, okay, why did I slip? What should I have done when I was at the 100th step?
Yes.
So that I would have taken those precautions and not slipped down 200 steps again. You know, what should I have done when I was at the 150th step?
Yes.
You know, okay, next time when I'm falling, how should I stop?
Yeah.
Should I allow the free fall? Should I again fall by 100 steps? Or in case I fall, can I stop it when I'm just 5 steps or 10 steps down? So all those learnings, I think, we gather as you walk on this journey.
Do you know, we do that for everything else.
We're
learning to drive, learning to walk.
Exactly.
That kind of dynamic feedback is what's happening in our body, physically,
as
well as mentally. It's already happening.
Yeah.
So why can't we apply that to spiritual things and to, you know, everyday things like anger?
Yes.
What comes to mind is a little experiment that I did some years ago. And you mentioned at the outset in the introduction, Love at Work. And Love at Work, the pillars of Love at Work really are firstly to do a simple repeated action that connects you to your higher self. And secondly, to reflect at the end of the day. Thirdly, to have the company of good people, such as what Swami mentions in 7.3, this paragraph, that in fact you should drop everything and run towards that good company. And that's one of the pillars of Love at Work. So a few years ago, I was asked to give a talk at one of the Sai centers, and it was for Swami's birthday, actually. And it was probably the biggest event that I had spoken at. And of course, with anything to do with Swami, if somebody asks you, you say yes first and then figure out how to do it later. So I was in the same situation. And I thought, this occasion, I'm asked to speak. I'm asked to use my voice. So I must ensure that my voice is pure, that this vessel is pure, that it's not tainted with any bad qualities. So in advance, of many weeks in advance, I took on this Love at Work practice of watching my speech, of refining my speech, purifying my speech. And I called it the Adieu Sadhana, A-D-I-E-U, which is a Shakespearean terminology term for bidding goodbye, bidding farewell, because my flag on top of Everest was to bid farewell to these five vices of the tongue. So A for anger, D for speaking derisively towards people, E for speaking excessively, I for speaking out of ego, and U for speaking untruths, the lapses of the tongue. So all I did was I would just watch myself when I made transgressions against each of these five parameters. And at the end of the day, I would simply record where were those instances where it happened, what was the circumstance, how did I speak in that way, you know, what impact I may have had on others and the impact I had on myself. Sometimes even people won't even know.
Yeah.
They would think it's normal for me.
Yeah.
But inside, I would know that I spoke out of anger there. I could have been a little bit more nice and pleasant and a bit more loving, a bit more obliging. And believe me, guys, over a few weeks, I found naturally that my self scores on all of these parameters were going down.
Yeah.
So simply by watching, you know, that W-A-T-C-H, just by watching,
yeah,
not even intervening,
yeah,
it actually helped me to reduce some of these vices
and
lapses of the tongue.
And tell me, as this course kept coming down, how were you feeling within?
The first feeling I had, Bishu, was a sense of accomplishment.
Okay.
That I can actually control myself.
Mm.
I can actually become a master of my own senses to some extent.
Mm.
Now, I hasten to add, none of this is possible without Swami's grace.
Yes.
You know, you can think anything you want, that you can control anything.
Mm.
But if he doesn't come and touch you, you will remain a stone.
Mm. Mm. So that was... What did this feeling of accomplishment, or what did this feeling of victory over yourself give you? How did it feel deep inside?
Well, deep inside, I felt a sense of contentment.
Mm.
That's the best way to describe it.
Mm.
I didn't feel any, kind of euphoria or anything. I just felt this deep sense of contentment. Ah, this is what it's like to be less angry in speech, to lie less, to speak with less ego.
Mm. So can I say it was a state of prashanti? It was a state of trying to reach the state of a prashanti, a very peaceful state within a state where you feel, you know, you're not really perturbed with many things and you feel very satisfied within.
It's like you're half the way through Everest and you're having a very nice view.
Yeah.
And you're enjoying that.
And you're enjoying the view. And I think that's a really nice interpretation of it, because it was a good feeling that prashanti is a very big term.
True.
It's top of the Everest.
Top of the Everest.
Is the important part. The three
years
at the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, it is a glimpse of that.
It's a glimpse of that.
Yes.
And what it, you know, the view that it gives you of yourself.
Yes.
This is what I'm capable of.
Yeah.
This is actually what my true nature is like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is not so angry.
Mm.
It does not put down other people.
Mm.
And it's a very good feeling.
Exactly. So, I mean, I was just trying to come to what Vikas was saying. How do you know if you're climbing the right Everest or not? Are you climbing the right mountain? If you're getting that very great feeling inside, you know, if you're getting that feeling which one day could make you really feel like prashanti inside, you know that, you know, where you're going is definitely in the right direction.
Yeah. Just two, three things before we get to the end. One, just to add to that last point, Bishu, I think, this whole path of love one to love all and serve one to serve all, you'll see many more numbers being added there if you're on the right track. So, you know, yesterday you just cared about yourself, your family and friends. Today you're caring a little bit more about more people and more beings. You know, and that numbers are getting added, and therefore you know that, you know, you're on the right track. Second thing to what Venkat said, I think introspection and reflection are tools that every spiritual tradition, religion really talks about, you know, and are key tools to look at yourself. Swami has really condensed that into a very nice acronym, WATCH, and simplified the whole concept. But introspection also, I see there's a continuum, you know, from actually taking a diary at the end of the day, saying, going through the whole day, saying, this is what I did right, this is what I did wrong, this is how I can improve. And that's a very practical tool, right? And I've seen people taking that from once a day to twice a day to then three times a day.
Yes.
Right? So that you kind of make amends more quickly.
Yes.
But I've also seen if you practice that really sincerely, there comes a time that introspection becomes like your breathing.
Beautiful.
So every act that you're doing or about to do, you get an immediate feedback.
Yes.
And then it is at in that moment that you can decide whether to do it or not. Sometimes, obviously, it takes a lot of courage to say, okay, I don't want to go through this.
Yes.
Sometimes you go through this, but you know at that moment that you're doing the wrong thing.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so introspection and reflection are really important tools. And the last thing I wanted to just share this quote from the Bhagavad Gita, which is very relevant here. This is from the second chapter, Shloka 62 and 63. I'm just going to read the English translation of the Shloka. When you keep thinking about sense objects, attachment comes. This is the whole journey from, you know, attachment to anger to how everything is lost, and really connects with what we just discussed earlier. So when you keep thinking about sense objects, attachment comes. attachment breeds desire, the lust of possession, which, when thwarted, burns to anger. So that's how anger comes. You get attached to something, it breeds desire, you want it, lust, and then anger. And then anger clouds the judgment. You can no longer learn from past mistakes, and therefore you can't reflect, you can't do introspection then.
Yes.
Lost is the power to choose between the wise and the unwise, and your life is utter waste. So this is Shloka 62, 63 of the second chapter, if you want to look at it more.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that reminds me of a direction that Swami once gave to a very senior devotee of yesteryear, 1940s, 1950s. And, you know, Swami said to her once, okay, what sadhana are you doing? And she wanted to know if she's progressing on the spiritual path. And she narrated, you know, whatever she was doing. Swami said, you'll never grow like this. What do you mean, Swami? We are in the ashram and we are doing all these activities. We are doing this japa, we are doing the dhyana, we are doing whole days spent doing all these sacred activities. And Swami said, no, that will not take you anywhere. So what had happened was 90% of her activity was doing all these spiritual, so-called spiritual practices, and only 10% was introspection. Swami said, it has become opposite. You should continuously only introspect.
Yes.
Every time I speak, I should introspect. Yes. If you have to grow, then, as you mentioned, that change has to happen. So you don't grow just because I'm chanting 1008 times Ramanama today, and you know, day after I will chant 1008 times twice.
Yes.
I mean, that definitely you have used the time in a pious way.
Yes.
But for spiritual progress to happen, you have to introspect every time you're speaking something, every time a thought emerges, every time you're doing any act. And I think that's what, you know, because you referred to, and this is what really Bhagwan had said. And
you know what? This is already happening in us.
Yeah.
And I mentioned some practical examples like driving, walking, talking, etc.
Yeah.
We're already having that introspection. That's how the second iteration of that same act is different, because it's been informed by that delta, that change. And now, you know, you mentioned about as you expand, you're adding ones. So you're beginning to move towards all in increments.
Yes.
And that's how you measure success. Another way possibly could be that through this introspective process, the time gap between error and correction
yes.
is reduced.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, for example, say if I'm speaking angrily, going back to my adieu sadhana, and if I say something angrily towards you, Vikas, right? I would never dream of doing that because I love you. But say I spoke angrily towards you. I might let it go. And after 2 or 3 days, I might say, oh, you know, maybe that Vikas is feeling bad. I should go and apologize to him. What I found in myself was, over time, if you keep doing this, don't give up. You can't rest halfway up. If you keep doing it, that time frame reduces from 3 to 2 to
yes.
1 day
yeah.
to 1 second.
Yes. Yeah.
Instant. As soon as I say it, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that. And in fact, then it even becomes even it retrogresses,
yes.
if you like. Yeah. So that even in your mind, you're able to catch that angry sentiment and hold it before it expresses itself.
Absolutely.
The level of awareness increases so much that you can catch it at the birth of the thought. At source, yeah.
And that's a very good feeling too, because you think, I could have really done some damage there.
Yeah.
Swami, by your grace, thank you, Swami, for coming at the right time at my thought level and holding me back.
Beautiful. And I think Swami said that is the reason why he gave the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna and not Dharmaja, Swami said, because Arjuna did Purvatapa and Dharmaja did Paschatapa. He would repent after the action was done.
Right.
But Arjuna wanted clarifications before the action.
Right.
You know, so I think, so if you really go to that state, then there will be a Bhagavad Gita that Bhagwan will give us from within.
Yeah. Wow. We just read the Bhagavad Gita, we could be expressing it.
And then, you know, he will become our Partha Sarathi, so there is no problem. Beautiful. Thank you so much, brothers, for this lovely session. Really grateful to Swami that he made it happen. Dear brothers and sisters, I know we've just started discussing segment 7.3. There's so much here. I mean, each point is possibly one book or more. But then we'll just try and share a few thoughts. As you please, when you have time, open the pages of this beautiful treatise that Bhagwan has written for us. And whatever thoughts you have, whatever experiences you are going through as you practice these in your lives, please feel free to share them with us. Let us together move on this journey from I to we to he. Thank you so much. As always, you can write to listener@radiosai.org. You can also send us your comments on our WhatsApp number 9393-258-258. We offer this little endeavor with humility and love at his lotus feet. Thank you so much. Sairam.
Sairam.
Sairam.